Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
Frédéric Bastiat, the wonderful 19th century French economist and statesman, one of the most capable exponents of the principles of liberty protected by law, described this process as creating the antidote and the poison in the same laboratory. Other people have talked about it as a case of an arsonist moonlighting as a fireman, or vice versa, fireman, fire chief, moonlighting as an arsonist. Back in the early 1990s, there was a movie that came out that was a parody of Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct called Fatal Instinct. It starred Amand Asante, and I can't remember the name of the actress who was in Stripes and had originally been cast to play Catwoman as the femme fatale. And come to me, Sean Young, I think her name was. If not mistaken, she also played a replicant in the 1981 adaptation of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick called Blade Runner. Many of you have seen that, no doubt. It's a wonderful movie. I think it's a classic. In any case, Sean Young played the femme fatale. Armand Asante played a man who was a police officer who moonlighted as a defense attorney. So he would lock them up during the daytime hours, then at night he would go to night court and defend them and get them off. You're talking about the process of creating a problem that provides a pretext for a solution that you really seek as your primary objective. Some people, of course, propose solutions for problems. Other people are in the business of creating problems to justify preordained solutions. That's what we're talking about here with respect to the Iraq War. Saddam Hussein was, in every reasonable and relevant sense, a problem inflicted on the Iraqis by the United States and some of its allied governments, the Anglo-American elite, and what other governments they could browbeat, bribe, cajole, suborn into supporting their actions. He was installed with the help of the CIA. He was entrenched with the help of the CIA. His war, his aggressive war against Iran, was abetted by the Carter administration. And then it was aided by the Reagan administration, which was playing both sides off against each other in this conflict that, although it took part at the it took place at the periphery of the Western world's attention, it ended up being a war that was every bit as devastating as much of World War I. You had a situation where Washington was supporting both sides, but it had abetted the aggression by Saddam Hussein, who was the aggressor in the war against Iraq. As late as 1989, the George Bush, the elder administration, was actively promoting military transfers and military support, material support for the Iraqi military, as a matter of national security. There were national security waivers signed by George Bush, the elder, within a few weeks of the invasion of Kuwait in 1990 that precipitated the first Gulf War. And April Glaspie, the presidential envoy to Saddam Hussein, made a point of drawing a security perimeter that excluded Kuwait, all but inviting Iraq to invade Kuwait over what appeared to be some pretty plausible grievances on the part of Iraq with respect to matters of national boundaries and oil claims and things of that sort. The Iraqis were complained about the practice of slant. They were complaining about the practice of slant drilling. Supposedly, Kuwaiti oil prospectors were violating national boundaries, which were, I think, ludicrous to begin with. I think that Iraq was created as sort of an afterthought of the Sykes-Picot Agreement after World War I, when the Anglo-American elite spread out a map of the world on the floor of a building that was rented by the Inquiry. That was a little group put together by Walter Lippmann and some of the other folks who went on to create a charming little outfit called the Council on Foreign Relations. They literally spread a map of the world out on the floor of an office, and with a pencil stub, they started to divide up the known world, divide up Europe, divide up the Balkans, divide up the Middle East, basically scattering tripwires across all these territories that would later on provide all these problems that justified military solutions and imperial assertions of power. And Iraq was one such example, but one of the lines that they had drawn, who knows who was wielding the pencil stub who drew that line between what would become Iraq and what would become Kuwait, one of those lines ended up creating the pretext for the 1991 Gulf War. And after 1991, you had, as part of the armistice agreement with Saddam Hussein, a side deal that allowed them to keep the helicopters that were used to suppress the Kurds and the Shiites. In other words, care was taken to ensure that Saddam Hussein would remain entrenched in power, in spite of the fact, or maybe in complement to the fact, that the Bush administration had actually urged the Shiites and the Kurds to rise up against Saddam. It might have been, I'm thinking now that George H.W. Bush was a spook. He was somebody who had been a director of the CIA, and people of that sort, of course, are some of the vilest criminals who've ever drawn breath. It may have been the case that he wanted to surface, that's the expression, I know it's a vulgar use of the word surface as a verb, to surface the opposition so as to entrench Saddam Hussein. And later on, now, Robert Baer, in his book, I believe it's called Dancing with the Devil, Robert Baer, former CIA field operative, he's one of the guys who got involved in this out of patriotic intentions and became very disillusioned with what happened. If you've seen the movie Syriana, starring George Clooney, that's basically what Robert Baer was involved in. It's heavily dramatized, almost to the point of parody and caricature. But that's the sort of thing that he was involved in. That movie was based on a story treatment of books of Baer's memoir, I believe, Dancing with the Devil, and then See No Evil was his other book. But Robert Baer talks about the fact that between 1991 and 1996, the CIA was working in the northern part of Iraq to put together an armed coalition of dissidents and renegades for the purpose of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. But what they managed to do is they managed to cattle pen these people in an indefensible position, and then they betrayed to Iraqi intelligence every necessary detail to permit an assault on this pooled group of dissidents to wipe them out. And that happened, I believe, in the summer of 1996, if I remember correctly. Now, there's an expression in CIA speak called the Budapest Rules. And the fact that this expression exists tells you that the CIA has been in the business of betrayal for a long, long time. What happened in Hungary was very, very similar. After Hungary had been taken over by communists aligned with Moscow, there was a group of people who were organized sort of loosely around Cardinal Mindszenty, who was the cardinal in charge of the Catholic Church in Hungary. I think that's sort of a vulgarization, a vulgar description, but I think that's a suitable one for our purposes. There was a Catholic-led resistance to communism. That's not surprising. I mean, it's a Catholic country, and communism, of course, is not known for its congeniality to Christianity in any form. Catholicism, of course, would be under that malediction. Mindszenty organized and motivated people. He didn't really organize. He wasn't out there taking names. He wasn't out there writing checks, but he was somebody who gave voice to the opposition to the betrayal of his country into the hands of communism. And there was an underground in Hungary that was working to overthrow the Quisling regime that had been imposed upon Hungary by the Soviet Union with the help of Winston Churchill, with the help of Alger Hiss. You know, or at least you should know, some of the some of the malefactors responsible for this. Well, the CIA had been in Hungary organizing these people to resist when, in 1956, the tanks rolled in. Khrushchev sent in the tanks to crush the resistance in Hungary. Eisenhower had urged the Hungarians to rise up. They rose up, expecting support from the West. The support never came, and they were slaughtered. And so, in the operations directive for the CIA, there's a phrase, the Budapest Rules, which refers to this time-honored practice. Who knows if this is deliberate? At least as far as the policymakers are concerned, maybe this could be deliberate as far as those who carry out the policy. Who knows if this is their intention? But the time-honored practice of arming, equipping, and mobilizing resistance to a totalitarian dictator and then letting them get slaughtered. It happened in Budapest, it happened at the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and it happened in northern Iraq in 1996. It happened in Iraq in 1991, as a matter of fact, and this is something that the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, had done. Rise up against Saddam Hussein, rise up against the dictator, we'll help you. Oh, by the way, we're going to let Saddam Hussein keep his attack helicopters and you'll get mowed down like grass. But rise up nonetheless. And we wonder why those people hate us so badly? It's the voice of experience. Be back with other reflections and observations of this sort after the following message. This is Will Grigg for Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. It's amazing that Henry Kissinger, of all people, would have had either the honesty or the brazenness to say that while it may be dangerous to be America's enemy, it's fatal to be America's friend, because that's true. So file that under the heading of even the devil can cite scripture to his purpose. I think I'm paraphrasing that pretty closely. Henry Kissinger said that. Henry Kissinger is one of the chief architects of that type of institutionalized perfidy. And Iraq is a really good example of how that plays out. Once again, just to hit the low points here of the history, Saddam Hussein was inflicted on Iraq in the late 1960s, but he came to power as their regnant dictator in the 1970s with the help of the CIA. In 1980-1981, he declared war against Iran. It was an aggressive war. He received the specific and repeated support of Washington, up to and including the receipt of a presidential envoy in the person of the future Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in 1983. Following this, we had a situation in which Saddam was receiving help from both the West and the East, from both Washington and Moscow. He was receiving help in terms of financial aid. He was receiving help in terms of material aid for his military. The way things worked out, by 1990, he was an ally of the United States, and he was egged into a war against Kuwait to address what he considered to be Kuwait's aggression against their oil fields through slant drilling, violating one of these lines that have been drawn by an august personage by working for the inquiry after World War I. After that war, that 100-hour land war, you remember, and of course it began with an air campaign, which Baghdad was the first target, Saddam Hussein remained in power. George H.W. Bush urged the Iraqis to rise up against their dictator after he had very thoughtfully instructed General Schwarzkopf to leave Saddam's military in possession of the attack helicopters that would be used to wipe out the Iraqi resistance. So the Iraqi resistance was urged to rise up. It's like a track two effect. Anybody remember those track two commercials? The first blade pulls the hair taut, the second blade cuts it off. It was sort of a track two effect. George H.W. Bush had them rise up. Saddam Hussein mowed him down. But this was a razor that was provided to Saddam Hussein in the form of those attack helicopters by the United States. Flash forward about 4 or 5 years. You have a group of CIA-trained and equipped Iraqi resistance units, Shiites for the most part, in the northern part of Iraq, who were betrayed in exactly the same way. They were surrounded by armored columns and mowed down. This is at a time when everything that took place in Iraq took place at the sufferance of the United States and its allies, because Saddam was not even the master of his own territory. There were two no-fly zones, one in the north and one in the south, that patrolled the airspace over Saddam's nominal area of sovereignty. Within the no-fly zone to the north, you had an infestation of Al-Qaeda elements they were operating with impunity under the air cover provided by the United States and Great Britain. And from time to time, usually on a weekly basis or even more frequently than that, you had punitive strikes, missile strikes, airstrikes being made against Iraq. But all these things were going on, and yet Saddam was able to send out a major military element to wipe out his internal resistance, which had been put together with the help of the CIA. That, of course, is in harmony with what the CIA calls the Budapest rules. The Budapest rules are basically, if the order comes down that we are to cut off aid and support and leave people to whom we've made promises of support twisting in the wind or dangling from the end of a noose, that's what we do. It's what they did in Budapest in 1956. It's what they did with, was it Brigade 8560 at the Bay of Pigs in 1961? It's what they did with the Iraqis in 1991 and 1996. And then the United States invades in 2003, and we find out that the Shiites don't particularly like us. It's because they have a memory longer, I think, than your typical American TV consumer. But we shouldn't be doing any of these things. And that's, of course, the most important point in this discussion. The government ruling us has no constitutional authority to do any of these things. It has no mandate to be propagating democracy anywhere or to be promoting American-style constitutionalism at the point of a gun. That's not within its delegated powers. But as Joseph Sobran likes to say, our Constitution is no threat to our current system of government. Now, the Wall Street Journal, referring to the supposed victory in Iraq, says the following: "This admirable American effort has now given Iraqis the opportunity to govern themselves democratically." Oh, wow. That is just suffocatingly redolent of imperial condescension. You know, after destroying your country, after killing hundreds of thousands of you in two unjust wars and a 12-year-long suffocation embargo punctuated by terror strikes by aircraft and missiles, we now condescend to give you the opportunity to govern yourselves democratically. "We supported the Iraq invasion," says the Wall Street Journal, "primarily for reasons of U.S. national security." Well, if that were true, they would have opposed that invasion if national security were their chief desideratum, improving national security for the United States, given the fact, which is not mentioned in this editorial, which is miraculously free of facts, that the CIA admitted that the threat of terrorism, Islamic terrorism, was actually enhanced by what happened after the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. It was a net liability to the cause of U.S. national security. Not to mention, and this is interesting that they don't mention it given that the Wall Street Journal is supposed to be a newspaper devoted to economics, not to mention the fact that it's a hemorrhage to the public fisc. "But a successful war also held the promise that it could create in a major Arab state a model for governance that would result in something better than the secular or religious dictatorships that have so often bred brutality and radicalism, which has increasingly reached our own shores." Remember that phrase. Quote, "the secular or religious dictatorships that have so often bred brutality and radicalism, which has increasingly reached our own shores." I'll come back to that in a minute. "The fact that Iraq has a functioning judiciary and that Iraqi voters have rejected their most sectarian parties at the polls is cause for hope that the country is moving in that direction. They will have to do so," and there's a paragraph I'm omitting here for time, talking about the idea of democracy taking root and Iraqis taking up the burden of maintaining these glorious institutions inflicted on them at bayonet point by the United States. "The Iraqis will have to do so despite the continuing spoiler role played by Iraq's neighbors, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, who fear a democratic or Shiite-led state in their midst. The withdrawal of U.S. combat forces will only increase their ambition to create more trouble." Oh, wouldn't it be terrible if somebody were to interfere in the internal affairs of Iraq? after we're finished interfering in the internal affairs of Iraq? If these other neighboring states intervene, they at least have the beginnings of a defensible argument based on propinquity. They're there. That's their neighborhood. It is not our neighborhood. Just something to think about. We'll talk about this a little bit more on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Hope to hear from you. We'll be right back in a minute. Wall Street Journal editorial from August 20th is what I have been reviewing here, and I believe that the expression is fisking. I believe that's a neologism reflecting the work of Robert Fisk, the British journalist who excels at picking apart really bad arguments by going line by line and unpacking and demolishing the fallacies encoded therein. Just before the break, I was making reference to the fact that in this triumphalist editorial, the Wall Street Journal was lamenting, albeit elusively, the possibility that one of Iraq's neighbors might end up interfering in the internal affairs of Iraq. If you are not somebody in whom irony died long ago, that's something that would strike you as being almost toxic in terms of the intensity of the irony content thereof. This is laden, honestly, with contact lethal levels of irony, because the United States has never left Iraq alone. Now, if you were somehow to create a scenario in which, say, China were to intervene in the United States and inflict upon us, in the fashion of the forthcoming rewrite and remake of the film Red Dawn, a corporatist Maoist style government here in the interest of liberating us from our own admittedly corrupt government, there would be a debate about the possibility that Mexico and maybe Canada might interfere in the affairs of this newly liberated People's Republic of America. That's the closest I can come to an analogy that would illustrate the absurdity of the sentiment, you can't really call it an argument, contained in that passage. That makes the mission of the 50,000 U.S. troops that will remain as trainers, advisors, and special ops forces until the end of 2011 all the more crucial, continues the Wall Street Journal. It should also provide incentive for Washington and Baghdad to negotiate a more permanent U.S. military presence, both as a balancing force within the country and especially as a hedge against Iran. Having sacrificed so much for Iraq's freedom, the U.S. should attempt to reap the shared strategic benefits of a longer-term alliance, just as we did after World War II with Japan and Germany, which we've never left. Oh, boy. I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been Tacitus. Tacitus, of course, was the one who said of the imperial elements within Rome, you create a desert and you call it peace. The idea is that you can always create a supposedly defensive rationale for expansionism. As you expand your borders have to be defended. That means you put up a buffer zone in order to defend your borders, and you have to defend the buffer zone. And pretty soon, until somebody stops you, you've managed to absorb everything in sight. It's the same logic here. Well, we invaded Iran, not yet, but we invaded Iraq, and we liberated these people from a problem that we imposed upon them decades ago, and in order to preserve their gains and the interest of making sure that they're free and independent, we have to stick around a little bit longer and make sure that they remain free and independent of everybody but us. Honestly, it's the same message that you would have heard 30 years ago from a Soviet apologist defending the invasion of Afghanistan, which once again, as horrific as it was, actually is more defensible to the extent that Afghanistan abutted the Soviet Union. as opposed to being halfway around the world from the Soviet Union, the way Iraq is halfway around the world from the United States. It's interesting as well to think that the U.S. Army's Central Command deals with the Middle East. That's interesting as well. On the eve of war in 2003, continues the Wall Street Journal, we wrote, about one thing we have no doubt, the courage of the Americans who will fight in our defense. Well, that's a lie. Because nobody who fought in Iraq fought in our defense. This was not a defensive war on the American side. The courage that was displayed, and I will say this in full knowledge of how this will sound to most people, the courage that was displayed in the defense of home and family was the courage displayed by Iraqis who shot at the Americans who invaded their country without cause or warrant. That was courage. You have a tiny, poor country that have been suffocated for 12 years by an embargo, bombed every single week. They had been invaded. They had been brutalized. They had a dictator that had been inflicted on them against their will. They were invaded by the world's most powerful military. And it's the bully in that equation that expects accolades for courage. That is obscene. The Iraqis who shot at American troops were heroes to the cause of patriotism. The Americans who invaded that country were armed robbers. And I say that as somebody who wants those Americans to come home safely to their families. But it was utter perversity to send American men, and God forgive us, women, into Iraq, into a situation where they would be forced to kill men who were defending their homes. I've talked about this before, but it's worth repeating. The only war that's worth fighting is one where you have your back to your family and your face to the enemy on soil that you belong to. Once again, does anybody else remember that line from Red Dawn, which I guess now has canonical status in terms of its strategic wisdom? There's that horrible scene in which the two brothers who were leaders of this teenage resistance cell in the mountains of Colorado are about to execute a traitor and a captured Soviet soldier. And one of them turns to the other and says, I'm not going to do this. What's the difference if we're just going to murder these people? What's the difference between us and them? And then Patrick Swayze's character, whose name I can't remember, said, the difference is we live here. Well, you know what? The Iraqis lived there. They weren't terrorists when they were shooting back at Americans. They were patriots. They were partisans. They were resistance fighters. If we were on the receiving end of exactly the same kind of supposedly benevolent invasion, I don't doubt for a second that each of us would do the same things. We would be the ones who would be manufacturing and concealing IEDs. We would be the ones who would be sniping from rooftops and setting traps. We would be the ones who would be taking refuge in churches rather than mosques and using whatever we had by way of fighting back against an overwhelmingly superior conventional army. And yet here the Wall Street Journal is trying to say that those who were sent to Iraq would display courage in fighting for our defense. There's no courage involved in this. There could be a certain type of, a certain type of rudimentary, instinctive boldness, the same type of boldness you might see in a turf fight involving urban street gangs. They fight for their buddies. But there's nothing commendable if you have an urban street gang display that boldness in fighting against another urban street gang. That's not courage. You might admire the intrepidity of people who were doing such things. But the true courage consisted of those who were willing to stand up and face the aggressors and protect what was theirs. And God forgive us for putting Americans into a position where they are the bad guys in that equation. Why aren't we offended by this? Why aren't we mortally offended by the fact that there were good, decent men, and once again, women, who enlisted in the U.S. military and got cast in the role of the marauding, invading Imperial military? The Redcoats. Actually, it's not. I don't even think the Redcoats behaved that way. It's more like those wearing the hammer and sickle, or the Red Star, of the Red Army as they invaded Afghanistan. This was a war that had no legal or moral justification, which means that every life that was taken, that was lost, was the result of a criminal act. It was mass murder. Every Iraqi, every American who died in that war was a murder victim. Every single one of them. Which is really weird because a lot of the murder victims were murderers themselves in terms of the side that they fought for. And yet you have this pathetic, wizened little man, George W. Bush, and that deranged biological sack of malice called Dick Cheney, being hailed as if they were statesmen rather than being hauled away to the dock to face trial as war criminals and mass murderers. And you have the Wall Street Journal, which of course is being run by Rupert Murdoch now, trying to celebrate all of this as if it were a victory of liberty, victory for liberty. Honestly, this is the sort of thing that would have been considered a little bit excessive by the editorialists of Pravda 30 years ago. This is Will Gregg, Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
Connecting this execrable Wall Street Journal editorial to another controversy whipped up with the help of the Wall Street Journal, that is the controversy over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, I want to focus on one line from the 6th paragraph of the editorial from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. One of the defenses that they're offering for this world historic crime that was the invasion and occupation of Iraq was that this occupation was necessary to create, quote, in a major Arab state, a model for governance that would result in something better than the secular or religious dictatorships that have so often bred brutality and radicalism, which has increasingly reached our own shores. Now, the idea here is that the dictatorships in the region, the one in Saudi Arabia, most notably, have been the promoters and exporters of terrorism. If you take a look at the dictatorships in the region, you can't find a single one of them that hasn't been, well, forgive me, that's not quite true. Syria has never been a really, never in any sense been a client of the United States. It's been a client of Russia and then the Soviet Union before Russia. But Jordan, which is nominally an elected government, but of course has a king, has been promoted by the United States government. Its intelligence service, the Mukarabat, which is, I believe, the Arabic word that means intelligence service. That was the same title they used for the intelligence service in Iraq, was created with the help of the CIA, and it's long been known that the late King Hussein of Jordan was on the CIA payroll. You take a look at Egypt. Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. It has a nominally elected government, but it is a dictatorship in every relevant sense. And the current president come dictator of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, is not long for this world. He's terminally afflicted with cancer, and when he goes, things are going to get really interesting in the most important Arab country in terms of diplomacy and military strength in the region. That's something that really causes sleep to depart from my weary eyes as I put my head on the pillow after a day expended in the defense of liberty, is the question of what's going to happen to Egypt, because Egypt is an important country, and Mubarak is not long for this realm. but he has been supported by the United States as well. Saudi Arabia has been supporting Washington through the petrodollar entente, which was created by Henry Kissinger in the 1970s. They've always been very, very close to the United States. Everybody made a big deal about President Obama bowing in the presence of King Fahd? I believe he's still the regnant monarch, the Saudi monarch in any case. But nobody makes a big deal out of the fact that George W. Bush walked around hand in hand with this guy. I mean, it's not as if this gesture on the part of Barack Obama was unprecedented in terms of displaying a type of improper intimacy or deference to the Saudis. That's been a matter of policy since Roosevelt. And of course, if you go throughout the region in a larger scope of things, you take a look at what happened with the Shah of Iran, the fact that an elected government was overthrown in 1953, albeit elected government that had, in a condition of siege, suspended the parliament. It was overthrown by a joint U.S. and British intelligence operation, replaced with one of the most gruesome dictators of recent memory, Shah Pahlavi, with his Sabak intelligence service, which excelled at really innovative medieval-style tortures, including thrusting out the eyes of the opponents of the Shah. This is done on our dime. And Iran's nuclear program, little-known fun facts about Iran, Iran's nuclear program actually began under Shah Pahlavi way back in the 1970s. So this is all an example. These are all examples, rather, of what the Wall Street Journal was talking about by way of defending the invasion of Iraq. It's to create a model, an alternative model, to the secular or religious dictatorships that have so often bred brutality and radicalism. That's really interesting because Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the thoroughly establishmentarian Muslim Sufist cleric who's the head of the Gadorba Initiative, this is a guy who was cultivated by the establishment for the last 10 or 12 or 13 years. His degree is in physics. He's not a cleric. He's not a classically trained Islamic scholar. He's got a degree in physics. This is a man who's a product of the modern world. He's attended the Aspen Institute. He's part of the Religious Advisory Board of the Council on Foreign Relations, which means that he's really intimate with the establishment up to a certain extent. He's collaborated with the FBI, which I find troublesome, as I find troublesome his connections to this American establishment. He's being depicted now as a wild-eyed, would-be Islamic fundamentalist and jihadist. He's none of the above. But he has actually criticized the establishment, and for criticizing the establishment in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, he was supposedly displaying the disposition of an anti-American radical. This is what he said. You probably heard what he said about how the policy of the United States government was an accessory in what happened on 9/11 because Osama bin Laden was made in the United States. That's true. Osama bin Laden was part of a Mujahideen movement that was funded and organized and equipped with the help of the CIA working through Pakistani intelligence at a time when President Zia, who was a military dictator in Pakistan, was on the payroll of the CIA. But Abdul Rauf, the imam behind the Cordoba Institute, supposedly displayed his radical credentials by even daring to bring this up, by saying that the United States government had been promoting dictators in the Middle East and that dictatorship cultivated radicalism. Well, it's the same thing the Wall Street Journal was saying in their editorial yesterday. Here's another really interesting juxtaposition. Just a couple of days ago, Newt Gingrich, the self-appointed teacher of civilization, he's the de facto leader of the neocon lynch mob that is trying to arrest the public against the Cordoba Institute. A couple of days ago, he published an op-ed column for National Review. This is what he had to say, quote, "Far from defeating terrorism, today's government-to-government foreign aid system can actually incite it by propping up corrupt and repressive one-party states." This is the same Newt Gingrich who a couple of weeks ago was trying to say that Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf is a radical Muslim cleric, anti-American in disposition, and that he's trying to erect a victory mosque within some critical sanctified perimeter of Ground Zero. This is what Abdul Rauf said, as paraphrased in the June 23rd 2004 New York Times interview with Chris Hedges. Ralph told Chris Hedges, reported the New York Times, quote, Islamic terrorists do not come from another moral universe. They arise from oppressive societies that Washington had a hand in creating. Isn't that exactly the same thing that Gingrich said? Isn't that exactly the same thing that the Wall Street Journal said? So why is it defensible for the Wall Street Journal to say this and for Newt Gingrich to say this, but somehow when it's said by Imam Rauf, it suddenly becomes a symptom of incorrigible, incurable anti-American radicalism? Well, to a certain extent, I guess it's the singer and not the song, because they seem to be on the same page. Ah, but there's another important distinction here. Gingrich and Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, they can criticize American foreign policy, as Glenn Beck, by the way, did back in April of this year, in terms very similar to those that he later condemned when they were expressed by Imam Rauf. These people all support an imperial foreign policy that takes advantage of the problems cultivated by Washington as pretexts for war and military violence. Imam Rauf doesn't support that foreign policy. He would prefer that the United States be governed by the Golden Rule. As a matter of fact, he said so explicitly. He was asked by Foreign Policy magazine, Foreign Policy, which is published by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's an Orwellian name. The Carnegie Endowment actually has been involved in propagating warfare. And not uniformly, not monolithically. There are people attached to Foreign Policy magazine who write intelligent things from time to time, contrary to the predominant tone of the corporate sponsor. The Carnegie Endowment, way back in the early years of the 20th century, conducted a survey and decided that the best way to bring about real change was to get the United States involved in a war. That's how we ended up in World War I to a certain extent. But Imam Rauf was interviewed by Foreign Policy and asked what his Ramadan message would have been for, I believe it was 2007, Ramadan 2007. And he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. If America's foreign policy were governed by that principle, it would be very popular throughout the world, including the Muslim world. So it's come to this. Here's an Islamic cleric, an Islamic imam, who's quoting to nominal Christians our own golden rule, our own two great commandments from both the Judaic and Christian traditions, and saying, why don't you guys try this? Well, why don't we? Having tried everything else, why not try freedom? That's how Bastiat would put it. Having tried every other approach to living, why not live according to the golden rule? It would certainly be an innovation and one that I would welcome. Thus ends hour two of Pro Libertate, the radio program on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so please stick around.